Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Layla Latif.
I'm David Jenkins.
I'm Josh Slater-Williams.
On the show this week, 44 years after the original, Halloween finally ends. A lovable reptile charms the residents of New York in Lyle Lyle Crocodile. And on Film Club, it's a celebration of the restoration of 1987's The Lost Boys. All coming up in Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. So, Josh, the two of us need no introduction. We have been firm internet pals for many years and now IRL pals. For those who don't know who you are, could you explain exactly what it is that you do?
What a loaded question. I am a freelance culture writer on film, TV and music for Little White Lies, among others, including the BFI Sight and Sound, Dazed, IED at the moment during London Film Festival, a couple of places, Line of Best Fit. And this is my first time on the podcast. I'm very pleased to be here.
Yeah, and you're here.
What's
for
an internet pal?
Basically just Josh and I spend all of our time DMing each other.
And that's before you'd met as in real life, yeah?
Yeah, Josh is actually the person that I kind of sync up with the most in terms of all of the places that we write. We have kind of quite similar outlets. But yeah, we are all absolutely exhausted on this podcast because it is the middle of LFF and not much sleep has been had. David, you're also working on the new issue.
Yeah.
Are you still able to get a bit of LFF in?
Well, not really. I'm sort of, if you can hear a little bit of croak in my voice, yeah, that's the sort of late nights, early mornings kicking in. Working hard on the new issue to get it out on deadline, which our sort of main production time sort of happens to sync up almost exactly with London Film Festival. So I haven't really been able to dip in as much as I'd have liked to be honest. I've missed quite a fair few things that I'd really, really keen to see. I think we're going to do a little London Film Festival chat now. So I'm actually going to be listening to what you guys have actually seen and be jotting that down because I'm still kind of going to be playing catch up on that. But one thing to note also is that this is the week where, well, next week is when Decision to Leave comes out, which is the new Park Chan-wook film, which is on the cover of our current issue, in which your bad selves both have writing in that. So there's three good reasons to urge people to go out and pick that up now. Park Chan-wook's actually going to be in London for the London Film Festival. He's arriving today. Well, at time of this recording, I think he's probably sort of winging his way over because he's just been in New York. So, like, hopefully he'll actually get to see some of the issues. Someone might, you know, sneak him a copy. Yeah, we'll see.
Funny you mentioned that, David, because I happen to know that Josh is actually talking to him during the London Film Festival. I've heard he's absolutely wonderful to interview, so I'm actually pretty jealous. I'm deep in kind of junket mode myself, but I haven't really had a chance to ever talk to Park Chan-wook. So, yeah, jealous of that one, Josh. But aside from that, what have been your highlights? You're doing interviews, you're seeing a lot of films, though, as well, I imagine.
Well, it's always that thing during the London Film Festival where I feel like I'm seeing a lot of films, and then as soon as I skip something to go do an interview, I feel like I'm not seeing anything based on Twitter hype. But yeah, I've seen a lot of good stuff this year. I think it's been quite unfortunate. The only things I've not really liked have just been a bit mediocre rather than outright terrible. Yeah, I've been speaking to some great filmmakers like Manuela Martelli, who's the debut director of this Chilean film called 1976, which is set during the Pinochet dictatorship and follows a bourgeois housewife who sort of accidentally becomes a spy of sorts, which I really, really enjoyed. I'd say some other highlights I have, a couple of them were kind of holdovers from like festivals like Venice and Locarno, but they would include Blue Jean, which is set during 80s Thatcherite Britain when Section 28 is coming in. And Piaf, which is this, it's a weird one to describe. It's like a body horror version of Secretary, I would say. It's kind of interesting. It's a film about like a kind of a sudden growth of appendage, in this case, a horse tail, for this like introverted young woman. But instead of doing a Cronenbergian, this is messing up my life sort of thing, it's kind of explores how this might actually empower this person. And the tail itself is almost like a sexual organ in a way. So it's this kind of weird, light on plot, but heavy on kind of atmosphere, strange body horror S&M thing, which is really, really good, actually. I forget if it's got any screenings left at the festival by the time this podcast will go up, but I thoroughly recommend people check that out. It possibly might be on BFI Player. Don't hold me to that.
S&M body horror. That sounds very up my street.
Also, one last one I would like to mention is Brother, which is from director Clement Virgo, which might be my favourite film of the festival. It documents the story, it's a time-hopping portrait of two West Indian Canadian brothers in Toronto, following them from childhood to the start of the 2000s and kind of exploring how mental illness, grief, and like the societal structures at play in the city kind of almost laser-focused on either putting them in jail or putting them in the ground. It's got an absolutely fantastic performance from a British actor, Aaron Pierre, who was in Barry Jenkins' The Underground Railroad and M. Night Shyamalan's Old last year. So that would be my biggest recommendation of this festival.
Wow, that's quite the range that guy has. Kind of like, you know, harrowing Barry Jenkins romance drama, mid-sized sedan in Old.
Mid-sized sedan, yep.
A star is being born there. But yeah, there is a kind of dark cloud over this festival, though. Josh, I know that the Edinburgh Film Festival is something that's quite important to you. And so that must have been, you know, tough news to hear of what's happening with CMI and that, you know, there's possibly, this might be the end for that festival.
Yeah, so for a bit of context for anyone who hasn't heard, the Centre of the Moving Image, which is based in Scotland, which is this charity body that oversees the venues, Edinburgh Film House and the Belmont Film House in Aberdeen, but is also in charge of the Edinburgh International Film Festival, which just celebrated its 75th year over the summer. For those who don't know, Edinburgh Film Festival is the world's longest, it's not necessarily the world's oldest film festival, but it's the film festival that's continually run for the longest. It's never taken a break. Even during COVID, it was one of the first film festivals to experiment with a small digital program that people could access over that respective summer. So what happened on last Thursday, out of the blue, by all accounts, the organization went into administration. So all action for the respective film houses and the film festival terminated immediately. Over, I think it's roughly 102 people lost their jobs immediately. By all accounts, there was no kind of warning that this might be on the way. So it's a terrible loss, you know, absolutely devastating for those people. Extremely sad, rage-inducing as well, because I'm slightly concerned that the gravity of the situation has been slightly underplayed in more of a UK national conversation. I think that there's a danger in kind of thinking of this as like a region-specific, you know, oh, well, these things happen. You know, people who equate it to a perfect storm of like the cost of living crisis and COVID. And not to say those are not factors in why the organisation was struggling, but there needs to be a greater deal of emergency in terms of preserving these cultural spaces for means of access, for means of education. I know both film houses ran loads of like educational services for students, children, and worked with like young aspiring filmmakers. My understanding that the loss of the Belmont Film House means there's like no accessible screenings for anyone who might, no, your regular sorts of like hard of hearing screenings, that those sorts of things. Yeah. So without going into any potentially libelous accusations about, you know, who's to blame for all this, I just want, you know, I think it's important that publications such as Little White Lies kind of get behind, you know, throwing their support for hopefully some sort of revival of these cultural bodies. And I have been pleased to see in the last few days a lot of prominent filmmakers come out in support of the festival and, you know, getting, you know, then the people who've lost their jobs and getting things back on track. Director Ben Sharrock, who made Limbo. He had a particularly eloquent thread on the impact of Film House on his his filmic education, how he wouldn't have any, he wouldn't be where he was without the film festival. And he had some, you know, very astute thoughts on, you know, what should arguably be done in terms of reforming an institution like that. And similarly, Andrew Partridge, who's the organization runner of Anime Limited and also the Festival Scotland Loves Anime, the Edinburgh wing, which was set to run at Film House this October, has now moved to Cameo. He produced a thread kind of going through the detail about the kind of procedures and all the costs about what was involved with getting that transferred to an entirely new venue. And I would say anyone who has any sort of interest in film exhibition programming, or I guess anime, should like go look up Andrew Partridge's thread on that, because it's really interesting and kind of gets across just the domino effect of this. It's not just an Edinburgh thing, how it affects, you know, the people directly involved, how it affects communities, how it affects organizations who are not based in the city. It's a really good thread about the ripple effects. And I'm going to stop rambling here, but I just thought it was important to like express some solidarity with the people who've lost the work there.
Yeah, certainly. And there's, you know, several of, you know, friends of the podcast and people that work with Little White Lies have, you know, been directly affected and lost their jobs. So, you know, it's kind of a personal thing for all of us, as well as just being, you know, deeply sad. And I'm sure, David, you were also bummed out.
You know, I don't want to sort of be standing quietly aside. I'm not a person who kind of like is very militant over social media. I don't believe in anything that might be construed as being performative, but like I've obviously been sort of watching this play out. I've been talking to people about it. You know, the news itself when it dropped was completely devastating. And from my perspective, it was the kind of like it kind of came from nowhere, especially because like there really wasn't a sort of public sense that these cinemas were kind of doing badly to the point of their instant extinction. And same goes of the Edinburgh Film Festival, which, having spoken to various people about that, including people involved in running the festival, internally it was deemed quite a reasonable success. I mean, I'm sure that there are conversations being had in the kind of, you know, higher echelons of the film community, people, you know, between sort of decision makers, people with access to funds. And I think every effort will be made to preserve Edinburgh. But yeah, I think it just all sort of boils down to a hope that, you know, just to echo what Josh was saying, people are able to see beyond a kind of hard bottom line and actually try and sort of comprehend the value of these festivals over this kind of the hard costs, you know, like what actually people are getting out of it and what they actually, the services they actually provide beyond revenue. So, you know, as you say, this climate, those questions are even tougher than they once were. But it feels like there's still time for Edinburgh to be revived for next year. Let's have everything crossed that happens and that those conversations are not just kind of like starting, but are kind of well underway.
Yeah, I would say Hafiz Salas Ross, who, you know, writes for Little White Lies and has been on this podcast, she was one of the people that was directly affected and lost her job. And she's just got a wonderful thread, if anybody wants to look that up, all about kind of the community engagement and like actually why this, you know, that sort of space is so much more than just a place to watch a film. It does feel a bit strange going on from something so serious to something that is fundamentally quite silly, but we should get started on Halloween Ends. Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. You'll receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our SETI HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies. 4 years after the events of Halloween Kills, Laurie is living with her granddaughter Allison. Michael Myers hasn't been seen since his last brutal rampage, and Laurie has decided to liberate herself from fear and embrace life. But when a young man, Corey, is accused of killing a boy he was babysitting, it forces Laurie to confront evil once and for all. So, I mean, it was quite a surprise at the beginning of this film. You feel like any one of these slasher movies kind of needs to start with a kind of self-contained kill, as so many of these things do. But we're kind of set up from the beginning that Michael Myers is not going to appear for a while. So what I do instead, I was sat next to you, David, and I did gasp and jump out of my seat. I was quite impressed by how inventive it was.
Yeah. I mean, to add some context to this, so like my experience of the Halloween franchise heretofore is the original John Carpenter, which I've seen numerous times, and I would say I like it. It's not a film I necessarily love. I can see why it's an important film rather than one that is maybe like great, but like, and I've seen Season of the Witch,
underrated,
and that's it prior to this. So like this was my baptism of fire. So I ended up knowing that I was going to be set to be talking about Halloween Ends. I speed watched the David Gordon Green new trilogy, which has appeared after two rebooted films by Rob Zombie, which take a slightly different timeline. And then you have the Halloween H2O kind of ironic meta Scream-esque versions, which appeared just at the sort of end of the 90s. It's a really handy flowchart on Wikipedia, actually, which gives you the sort of how all these films are connected to one another and the timelines that they go on. Because this timeline ignores every other Halloween film and is just linked to the first one. So it's kind of, it's purely reacting to the John Carpenter one, and like the way it's made and the intertitles and the music and the tone and the style of everything is kind of geared towards homage to the Carpenter version. It's very much in that tenor. Unlike I haven't seen the Rob Zombie version, but like I've seen Rob Zombie movies and I can't imagine that he's done them in any other way than his own kind of garish new metal way. Anyway, so yeah. Yes.
Actually, I mean, it was kind of more self, it was actually pretty dour, his version on it.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it was less fun. Fun Rob Zombie movies.
I know that there are some Rob Zombie hardcore out there, so I don't want to besmirch his good name, but like, yeah. So like, so this new trilogy, I watched the first one thinking, oh yeah, no, this, I'm sure that this had some good reviews, but I thought it was rubbish. And then the second one, Halloween Kills, was like absolutely abysmal, like one of the worst. And I know later you said that you quite like Kills, but you know, maybe that's for another day. But yeah, and so I was entering into this film at like, it was that sort of thing of like going between the two poles of, can this possibly be worse? Or, oh my God, if it is worse, I'm in for a ride. Like, I mean, this has got to be so bad. I mean, it's the third film in a trilogy. They've probably dashed it off as a kind of contractual obligation. But what actually seems to have happened is like Blumhouse, you know, the production company, have said to David Gordon Green, this is purely speculative, by the way, lawyers, so don't come after me for this. They've said, okay, crank out two crowd pleasers with like some gory kills that we can put in the trailer. And then for the third one, you can muck about and do what you want. And so like, I feel that David Gordon Green is like director for hire on the first two, where he's like, you know, he's got a brief, he's working for clients, he's getting sign off, etc. This third one, this is the David Gordon Green film. And to my surprise and delight, I actually thought the film was decent to good, like actually sort of one of the better horror films I've seen in a long time. Getting back to your question in a very roundabout way, yes, this opening gambit where you see this episode in this sort of tragic episode in this, you know, teenager's life unfold and sort of turn him down a kind of path of evil is interesting. And I think the reason why this film works and the previous two don't is because, yeah, as you say, Michael Myers is very much a kind of background spectral presence in this, whereas in the second one, he's the main character. So there is like literally no reason to be scared. All you're doing is watching these horrible, horrible murder scenes. So yeah, he's in the background and he kind of exudes this presence and influence on the town rather than actually being there and doing bad shit. So there is a sort of scary sense of like, oh God, they're trying to extend the franchise by making a kind of, you know, son of Michael Myers thing, but like, you know, it doesn't quite go that direction without spoiling it. So yeah, I'll pass the baton to Josh, but yeah, I was impressed with this film.
I will clarify just for any people who might be listening and freaking out about spoilers. He is not literally the son of Michael Myers. That is,
No. When I said son of Michael Myers, yes. I meant that was done in inverted quote marks that you couldn't see.
Yeah, it sort of reminded me of a sort of Renfield relationship in a little way. Anyway, what I was very surprised. I also found much to appreciate with this film, purely because I was surprised that I was surprised by a Halloween film in 2022. And one strange pop culture artifact that I was strangely reminded of was the video game Metal Gear Solid 2, which came out in 2001. And was obviously a sequel to a mega hit video game, and in all its advertising, kind of pushed, this is the return of the character Solid Snake, etc. And the opening of that game does sort of support that. But then the surprising twist that many gamers found, much to many's outrage, is that Solid Snake is not lead character. The lead character is actually some young upstart named Raiden, who everyone apparently hated at the time. I was strangely reminded of that, where it's not a story about Michael. It's a story about this young man who, I don't want to spoil the opening sequence too much, but yeah, he's implicated in a murder that he didn't necessarily commit, and it then jumps forward 3 years to 2022. He got off on those charges, but he's sort of like he's in the absence of Michael Myers, who. Got away at the end of the second film. I feel like it's impossible to talk about this film without spoiling the end of Halloween Kills. So the stakes.
Oh, yeah. Everybody's got to be up to date.
The very existence of this film spoils the end of Halloween 2. So.
Yeah. Just because it's only a year old. But yeah, the status quo is that at the end of that, Michael killed the angry mob who were after him, and also killed Laurie's daughter, who was played by Judy Greer, who is sadly missed from this cast, I will say. But anyway, so in the absence of Michael, who wasn't apprehended, he hasn't been seen since, the town of Haddonfield is sort of how they position the film, is that in the absence of that boogeyman, they're finding another one for, not necessarily for closure, because they can't get the closure from the Michael murders, but he's sort of like the target of physical abuse in some cases, a constant derogatory comments. He's just trying to get on with his life. The only work he can get is at like an auto shop, which it turns out is run by his own father. And yeah, for I would say nearly 40 minutes, this is a very strange horror, especially for this franchise. It's not, I wouldn't call it a slasher film for the first 40 minutes at all. It's almost like this curious character study of two young kind of lost souls, the other one being Laurie Strode's granddaughter, Allison, who has her own kind of, I hesitate to say trauma because I know everyone's sick of trauma in reference to these movies, but who has this own kind of traumatic weight bearing down on her from the loss of her mother and father in the previous two movies and all the stuff that went on. But she's now working as a nurse. Laurie sort of kind of instigates a meeting between these two young people, and they kind of get to know each other. And I was very surprised, I mentioned this to Layla off the screen, I was very surprised to be reminded of an upcoming film that I'm sure you're going to be covering, called Bones and All by Luca Guadagnino. I've missed...
Also David Gordon Green.
Yes, I was going to say, David Gordon Green has a small role in that film. I will say his scene in that is creepier than anything in this film. But I was strangely reminded that in that the film, for a while, becomes this sort of like young, messed up couple kind of getting involved with very violent acts. And Michael is sort of there. I don't think Michael Myers appears in this film for at least 40 minutes. At a certain point, I was wondering if they had pulled a Season of the Witch and just not put him in the movie at all. As David alluded to, this does feel more like a... I don't know if you can even call anything a classic David Gordon Green film anymore, because he's become such a hard director to get a handle on, but it did seem more in the vein of his earlier films, like All the Real Girls, in a way, albeit with a lot more murder and gory, stabby.
Yeah, I mean, I will say I liked Halloween Kills. I hated the first David Gordon Halloween. I just thought that sort of empty girl boss triumph at the end was like legitimately sickening. But watching Halloween Kills, I was kind of reminded of something that I think Elena Lazek once said, where like sometimes if it's not working for you as a horror movie, you should try and engage with it as a comedy. And I generally kind of settled into that just being actually a really fun parody movie of kind of almost like a scary movie thing. And I assumed we were getting more of the same with this. But as much as you say that this is like a kind of very David Gordon Green, like the tone of these three movies is absolutely wild. I would be, if you didn't know, I don't think you would guess that these were, those three films were made by the same person.
Well, that's I think that's what's so interesting about this film is that it somehow takes the kind of awfulness of the second one and parlays it into and takes sort of some maybe tiny seed of truth about this idea of like collective trauma or like, you know, this desire to immerse yourself in the in these lies and conspiracy theories and have these kind of folk demons, things that you kind of hate as a way to kind of get you through the day. And it kind of takes them and runs with that idea. And yeah, as you say, it's like the thing that this film has that the first two doesn't is like, you know, it has like basic storytelling logic. It has like characters who progress in a way that seems like that feels credible and authentic. And it's working on a much smaller, more intimate scale. You know, it's doing things that like the other two just completely ignored at the expense of these kind of grand histrionics and big, you know, gigantic themes that are supposed to sort of connect with the zeitgeist. Whereas, you know, this you know, I found the end of the film like very moving, actually. And Corey's journey and his kind of there is a kind of like, you know, to sort of make the connection, there is this kind of like almost sort of Darth Vader arc to his life, where he goes from like the sort of the uncorrupted youth of Anakin, and then, you know, just becomes this monster. But I think that the thing that really kind of takes you through the film is that that David Gordon Green is actually and the writers are doing something where you don't necessarily like, you know, you're not complicit in this idea of him being the boogeyman. In the same way you are with Michael Myers, who is just this monomaniacal, pure evil kill machine. They say it over and over again. He's just pure evil. It's like, well, you know, how is that interesting? You know, like, whereas you have a guy here who is like, you know, it is Jekyll and Hyde, and, you know, he is, you know, he's able to be charming and lovely, and, you know, has these kind of very romantic scenes, and then he will go off and put his scarecrow mask on and do some bad stuff. And yeah, I mean, I was trying to think, there can't be many third horror franchise, like part three of a horror franchise as good as this.
There's a few late in life good ones. The final Destination one is pretty good.
Yeah, I maybe Final Destination 3 is quite good. It's because there's one that it's like there is a kind of a Night of the Living Dead trilogy from like the 80s and 90s, the new ones. And there's actually Night of the Living Dead 3, which is this kind of, it is like it's basically they do like a Romeo and Juliet zombies with sort of like metal fetish S&M. And that's really good. And that actually really reminded me of this.
I would clarify, do you mean Return of the Living Dead?
That's it, Return of the Living Dead, not Night of the Living Dead. So it's the Return of the Living Dead 3, which is very good.
Although on that note, if we consider the first three their own standalone thing, I would cite Romero's Day of the Dead as a very good third.
Yes, no, yeah, you're right. Actually, the Dead films are the only ones who have been doing rocking that third part of the trilogy quality in the past.
And I know Nightmare on Elm Street 3 Dream Warriors has a lot of fans, so I'll stick up for that, even though I've not actually seen it. But I'll
stand corrected. It's almost like there's no bad third of trilogy.
No, not.
But yeah, I mean, I kind of see what you mean, but I think you're coming to it with a little bit of a kind of better will than I do. Because to me, so much of it just felt like contractual obligation, more from the actors. It seemed like though quite infrequently all together, it seemed like everybody was like, I'll give you 5 days. But then he did find this like really talented guy, Rohan Campbell, who looks exactly like the love child of Michael Rooker and Caleb Landry Jones. And that thread sort of compensates for the fact that I think Jamie Lee Curtis is like absolutely dreadful at this.
Oh, I beg to differ. I thought this was like, you know, this, the, if this was, you know, she could have Oscar buzz for this, I thought. Like, she was great.
Okay, well, you know.
Let's take this.
Disagree. Let's take this to the streets as well.
Let's go and get like a coal scuttle or whatever it's called and whack each other in the streets in the.
Before we wrap up, Josh, is there anything else you want to point out? I mean, were you impressed with at least kind of the grisly side of things?
Yeah, that links to my point. I found, as I say, I'm not sure how much I necessarily thought this was a very good movie or anything, but I do find it a fascinating one. I will say though, I appreciate it more as like dark drama than horror movie. I, outside of that opening set piece, I was not especially taken with the scenes that are actually meant to be scary in a way, or the suspense set pieces. I love horror films. I do get a kick out of, you know, gore and whatnot, and there's the odd fun thing there. But I don't want to say don't go see it if you're looking to, but I would not go into this expecting a lot of jump scares, I would say if you liked Halloween Kills, you're probably not going to like this one, which also seems to have been supported by Layla's assessment here.
But then nobody in their right minds likes Halloween Kills, so it's win-win.
Layla's right there, David.
That's why I'm saying it.
Let's get some scores on it because we've got some other stuff to get to. David, you want to go first?
Yeah, so into anticipation, one, of course, -1, -5, maybe. You know, I was expecting a bad time. Enjoyment, I would say probably, you know, it's like 3.5. You know, I know we're not allowed halves, but I'd maybe even teeter that up to a 4. And maybe in retrospect, a 3. I think my enjoyment was augmented by the fact that it was one of those things that had I had a higher anticipation, it probably would have been 3s across the board. But because my anticipation was so low, that there was a kind of pleasant surprise aspect, which maybe nudged enjoyment up a bit further. So there you go.
Like that you can't even in one sentence give David Gordon Green a full compliment. Josh, what about you?
Anticipation 1, I did not have a good time with Halloween Kills. I don't have an especially strong attachment to this franchise outside of Carpenter's one and Season of the Witch. Enjoyment 3, I was very pleasantly surprised to be so surprised. And the whole first hour, I genuinely did not know where this was going, frankly. And that was fun. In retrospect, I would say 3/2.5 because I feel like the third act kind of, it goes into the stuff that I wasn't so keen on. But I would recommend this definitely because I have not had a horror film experience quite like it at the cinema in a long time.
Yeah, probably for me, 1 in anticipation. Again, as much as like, the thing with Halloween Kills is that I thought it was really a fun parody. That's not what they were trying to do, but that was just like the level of appreciation that I had for it. And then, yeah, I kind of feel about this film the same way I feel about Venom. So in enjoyment and in anticipation, both 1s and 5s simultaneously, like it's quite nice to be completely bewildered, but I don't know whether that actually means it's good. But it's also, it's not boring. And that's something to say in this very kind of oversaturated horror market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Decision to Leave is the latest masterwork from Park Chan-wook, the filmmaker behind such modern classics as Old Boy and The Handmaiden. This twisted, passionate and surprising love story expertly blends together elements of romantic thriller, noir, black comedy and crime procedural, all to intoxicating effect. Critically adored at festivals around the world, the film saw Park win Best Director at the 2022 Cannes Film Festival and has been awarded a 5-star review by Little White Lies. Decision to Leave previews in cinemas nationwide from October 15th and is on general release from October 21st. Book tickets now at movie.com/decision to leave or via your local cinema. Decision to Leave is a movie release. Following the title reptile who lives in a house on East 88th Street in New York City, Lyle enjoys helping the Prim family with everyday chores and playing the neighborhood kids, but one neighbor insists that Lyle belongs in a zoo. Mr. Grumps and his cat Loretta do not like crocodiles, and Lyle tries to prove that he's not as bad as others might think. So Josh, most of what people kind of knew about this film before it came out was this like really bizarre photo of Javier Bardem in costume as his friend Hector P. Valenti. Did the film kind of live up to the weird and wonderful image that that was?
I was very pleasantly surprised by this film. so just to clarify, this is obviously pure family film. There's no attempts at elevated gravitas like Halloween Kills, which is also a family film doing the same thing. But I was very pleasantly surprised by this after slightly dreading having to go see it for the podcast. After my only real exposure to this, because I was not familiar with the children's book it's based on, were the big tube ads with Javier Bardem, Constance Wu, the child actor, I'm sorry, I forget your name, and Scoot McNairy crossing the sidewalk with Lyle. And I was just baffled by the fact that they felt the need to highlight that Javier Bardem was an Oscar winner, as though that was going to be a selling point for this particular film. On that note, I was pleased by how committed he was to the bit. Yeah, it's just a very nice little family film where everyone's putting in the effort. It's not annoyingly ironic or wink-winking about everything. It's like a sincere, taking its premise sincerely, and I thought the effects on the crocodile were actually very good. Its integration with the human actors, less so with the cat who keeps getting in peril. But yeah, it kind of pleasantly reminded me of something like Stuart Little, which I think it does resemble a lot. My only major misgiving is that the person who plays the singing crocodile, Shawn Mendes, is a pop star whose music, when I've encountered it, I have absolutely despised. And I don't really get along with his voice. So that was a bit of a stumbling block occasionally. But otherwise, I found this surprisingly enjoyable.
David, you've had not a great year in terms of children's films because you hated Sonic and you hated... what was the last one that we did? Minions. That was not... You weren't a bigger fan of that. Yeah. And with a young child, you have to go and see these things.
Both sequels. So, yeah. I was sort of going to this, not really knowing what was going to happen. So, yeah, I do take my daughter, age 4... to these screenings wherever possible, and this was something of a kind of new horizon for her in that she has been a sort of hardcore animation focus of her viewing, so doing the live action animation, which we tried to take her to see Clifford the Big Red Dog, but we didn't actually we missed that one in the end, so that we didn't have that precedent. I understand that's actually quite a similar... I haven't seen Clifford, but I understand that it's quite similar in sort of style and tone. But it was a spectacular success, and she was singing Top of the World for the rest of the day, and she was dancing to all the songs in the cinema. Every time a song came on, she would sort of stand up and do a little kind of bop, which was which even if you've sort of got one eye on the screen, it does lift the experience of seeing a movie like this, that that someone is getting so much enjoyment out of it. Which is not to say that I wasn't also. I agree with you on Shawn Mendes' kind of whiny voice. I was kind of expecting it to be like oh, it's going to be, the crocodile's going to be singing these kind of like jukebox classics that like Sony has in their kind of music archive. But like, yeah, that didn't happen in the end. The only kind of actual song he sings that is a pop song is Crocodile Rock, of course, by Elton John. I think its strengths is its sincerity and the fact that they have this character in the basement who he's called Mr. Grumps, and he is a Grumps, and he is the kind of, I guess he's sort of the antagonist, but he doesn't really have anything. He's a sort of side player and he doesn't really have anything to do with the plot. In fact, there isn't really a plot. The antagonist of the film is crippling anxiety, as the whole plot is engineered around this idea that Hector Valente, played gamely by Javier Bardem, wants to use Lyle to break into the showbiz industry and make loads of money, but does so in a way that is like, he's not necessarily this kind of evil, voracious, you know, talent agent type. He's in it for the fun, and doesn't necessarily want to exploit Lyle. And yeah, the whole plot is hinged on the idea that Lyle is too shy to sing in front of an audience. So he's able to sing with this family, and he kind of endears himself to them in that way. So to clarify as well, the crocodile can't talk. So there's no sort of kind of conversation with the crocodile, but when he wants to communicate, he bursts into song. Which, you know, the world would be a better place if that was how humans were able to communicate. But, you know, I digress. Unless you're Shawn Mendes. No, it's very, very, very sweet film. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily doing anything that is like very radical. And yeah, I agree. I think that the effects are sometimes really good. There's this sort of nerdy part of me was very impressed in a sequence where Lyle wrestles with Scoot McNairy in an attic, and the kind of the way it's filmed and the sort of interaction between the animated croc and Scoot McNairy feels, you know, it's very authentic. You don't get a sense that he's got some like, you know, that he's cutting away to some like rubber figurine that he's sort of chucking around the room. So yeah, that on a kind of tech level, it sort of it doesn't push the tech stuff too far, but what it does, it kind of does well. Yeah, sweet film.
Yeah, I kind of came into this morning thinking that, like, oh, you know, that was actually significantly better than I expected. I didn't know the source material, but I didn't have high hopes. But another bit of sad news is that Angela Lansbury has sadly just passed. And so I kind of spent a bit of my morning having a look at some old clips. And one of them was a bit of footage of her and Jerry Orbach singing Be Our Guest together. And I remembered that I went to review this thing at the Wallace Collection that was all about the influence of Rococo art on Disney. And I just kind of ended up then feeling like, you know, crumbs. Our children are getting crumbs compared to like the amount of talent and effort that went into like the stuff that I got to enjoy. So Angela Lansbury's passing has only kind of illuminated to me just kind of how dire the state of kids' films has really gotten.
It's true. I think with Pixar so kind of massively off the boil lately, that it's that situation is being compounded. And I think, you know, looking at this from in the long view, maybe a film like La La Crocodile is probably getting, you know, this is the week of low expectations being exceeded, and that maybe extends to the culture at large, certainly in the realm of family films.
God, well, we should get some scores before we get on to another little nostalgic treat. But Josh, I know you weren't that excited to hear that this was the podcast you were going to be on, but what did you think in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
Yeah, I'd say anticipation too, purely because I have no attachment to Lyles or crocodiles or a combination of them. Enjoyment, yeah, I'd say three. Yeah, very pleasantly surprised. Enjoyed a lot of the craft of the thing, some of the performances. And in retrospect, I'd also say three. Yeah, it's a solid family film. I'm not a parent, so I cannot speak to its relation to the quality of most that are coming out lately, like you two can, I'm sure. But yeah, I think this is a nice little movie.
I echo those sentiments and those scores. So you don't even need to come to me.
Yeah, probably 2-3-2 in retrospect, but you know.
That's Angela Lansbury thinking.
Yeah, that's the there. Angela Lansbury effect. The Lansbury factor. You know, I mean, you know, it's a very sad thing, even when it's someone the age of 96, but RIP to an unproblematic fave. Next up, Film Club. Two teenage brothers move with their mother to a small town in Northern California. While the younger brother Sam meets a pair of kindred spirits in some geeky comic book nerds, the older, angst-ridden Michael catches the attention of a local gang of vampires. It's then up to Sam and his new friends to save Michael from the undead. David, so, I mean, I don't really know what the reception to The Lost Boys was at the time, but I think it's something that's, like, generally remembered fondly. Do you feel that way about it?
No, not at all. Like, I think I saw this when I was quite young, maybe like late teens, and yeah, I don't remember like having any great fondness for it. This was at the age when you kind of like you films like The Lost Boys, you would end up watching like 6, 7, 8 times a year because you had it on VHS and your kind of rotation was massively limited. But even back then, I'm pretty sure I only ever watched this once and was like, okay, I'm fine with that. But you know, was coming back to it, thinking, okay, you know, Joel Schumacher has this sort of like maybe some of his reputation as a kind of, you know, style director has been lifted up. I mean, I think there are people who think he's a bit of a hack as well, and there are others who've kind of reclaimed those late Batman films that he directed, the kind of ultra camp ones. I sort of bedded in on a Friday night. Bottle of wine, takeaway pizza, ready to watch The Lost Boys, and yeah, it was just a gigantic disappointment on every level. Like a real like no evidence for me of like why this film is being celebrated for its 35th anniversary. I mean, I know that might sound very, very harsh. I mean, it's weird because this you know, on paper this you know, we should have had The Knives Out for Lyle and Halloween, but and been like. But phew, but thanks for the thank God for this like canonical cult classic. But no, it's flip reversed this week, where the cult classic is actually the one that is completely dire. Yeah, so it's a vampire movie, 80s. It's like it's got this kind of weird like 80s soft rock hair metal vibe to the whole thing. Everyone looks like kind of hipster new romantic types. You got Kiefer Sutherland with his little wispy white beard, and you've got Jason Patrick going around looking like a Levi's goon, and you've got the dad from Gilmore Girls popping up as well. And yeah, there's all this kind of weird mythology and all these rules and all these things that they have to do. And then you've got the Corey Haim and Corey Feldman, and you know, they're just sort of connecting bits of plot together, and nothing exciting really happens. And it's, you know, you've got all this kind of, there's lots of dry ice and lots of like guitar shredding and bad effects and terrible script, terrible, terrible plot. No, I think this is one for the bin. This is, yeah, put this on the trash fire. No 40th anniversary, no 50th anniversary. Let's erase this from the cultural consciousness. That's my take.
I thought I liked this, and it's weird because we talk now about how kind of like things get just like down to a meme or like a one perfect shot and what that's doing to cinema. But I think I only like the guy with the saxophone.
Yeah.
He's kind of playing topless.
Yeah.
And for some reason, through the prism of memory, I've extrapolated out that like that's kind of the vibe of the rest of it. So, yeah, I watched it again this morning and, like, Jesus Christ, it's not good at all.
That the guy with the saxophone, actually, yeah, that was the sole moment of levity. So, like, right at the beginning of the film, there is this kind of, like, outdoor concert happening and all the kids are, like, bopping along and the camera zooms over to who's on stage. And it is like this, what looks like a kind of oiled WWF wrestler wearing, like, purple lycra pants, like going crazy on a sax, and he's got like crimped long back length hair. It's a guy called Tim Capello. That's the name of the musician. There's actually, I think there's like, if you Google him, there's actually like, he's known as the kind of sexy muscle saxophonist of the 80s, who had some success as like a sideman for like, you know, he played like sax on various albums in the 80s and 90s, but has never sort of struck out as a lead. But yeah, he's become the kind of real true cult item legacy of this film.
When I was invited onto this podcast, I thought I was going to be chased off with pitchforks because I have never liked this film and I've given it so many chances. So I'm pleasantly surprised to see that's not going to be the case, that I possibly have slightly less harsh words on it. I first saw this when I was 13 in a double bill with Hellraiser, two films that you know, shouldn't have been watching at that time. But Hellraiser I now really like. It was just clearly a case of 13 is not the age to watch Hellraiser. But this one I struggled with at the time. I figured, oh, I was just a stupid kid. I rewatched it two Halloweens ago, thought it was still rubbish. Rewatched it again for this podcast. I just find it really flat. On paper, it should be a film I like a lot, based on various points that have already been brought up here. And I've been trying to pinpoint what it is that I don't care for. And I think part of that is actually rooted to looking into the behind-the-scenes history of it. So this was originally envisioned to be more of a family-aimed movie, to be directed by Richard Donner, who directed The Goonies and also did produce this film. But when he stepped down, Joel Schumacher was approached to take it over. And when he came on board, he reportedly insisted to raise the ages of the characters. So like the kind of brooding teenage vampires and were meant to be a lot younger, maybe 10 years old or something like that, maybe. Like, and so, you know, he got the screenwriter to revise the script, make it a bit more adult when it comes to like violence and sexual awakening and that sort of stuff. But that sort of makes sense, the vibe I get from it, where I don't think it escapes feeling like a kid's film that had adult elements bolted onto it. And I'm not a fan of The Goonies, so like if you tell me like, oh yeah, it's like The Goonies with vampires, it's like, no, I'm not really into it. And on that note, I do struggle with Corey Feldman in this a lot.
He's awful.
I get
genuinely awful.
I get what he's doing.
I think Corey Haim has a few moments, but I'm with you. Corey,
Corey Feldman's
terrible.
Yeah, may he rest in peace. Yeah, Corey Haim is quite good in this. I will, in light of the negativity amongst us all, I will highlight a few things I do like on this revisit. I do like the brotherly relationship between Jason Patrick and Corey Haim. I think that's quite sweet, even if Patrick himself is a bit of a wet blanket at times. I like the dog drop kicking a vampire into a bath of holy water at one point.
Yeah, that was okay.
And I like Jason Patrick's jumper in the last 20 minutes.
Yeah.
The Lost Boys, everyone.
Yeah, I don't remember the jumper, but I watched it with my wife and she was like going, when's this film going to actually start? When's something going to happen? Because like you kind of introduced to Kiefer Sutherland right at the beginning and then he kind of leaves the film for like an hour. You know, he's just this, you know, like you're like, where's Kiefer Sutherland?
I clocked it this time and vampire teeth do not appear in the film until roughly the 61 minute mark. And this is a 97 minute movie with credits. It saves it very late.
Yeah. Its other saving grace is the ending does have a few nice kind of gore things where it almost moves to sort of splatter territory for a moment. But yeah, it's as much as those elements are good in isolation as a film, as a singular piece, it's all over the place. The campaign to burn the negative of the Lost Boys.
Listeners
need to send, because you know we have three dissenting voices here, so listeners absolutely need to send reasons why this film is considered the cult classic that it is.
I would like to clarify, I do not encourage the burning of film negatives, but I will say watch Catherine Bigelow's Near Dark instead, a much better young vampire film from 1987.
Watch Street Trash instead. Where's that restoration?
Yeah. And what's the Tony Scott one with Bowie and
The Hunger?
The Hunger. Watch The Hunger instead as well. Yeah, like all of those are 1,000 times better.
People are not going to believe that we have praised Halloween Ends more than The Lost Boys.
No. Although I would say, as much as I've said that Jamie Lee Curtis was terrible in Halloween Ends, and I stand by her, I would come for another actress and say Diane Wiest is dire in this film. I've actually found it like upsetting.
Well, I mean, She's usually great, but she's just not given, you know, she's not really given anything to do here. So
I'm not undermining the talents. It's what she's been given to do. It's like absolutely horrendous, particularly that final scene. It really grated me. Anyway, I'm normally grateful to come to a cult classics, but yeah, I'm kind of slightly annoyed with you, David, that you made me start my day watching this one. But if you've got thoughts on these films or actually enjoyed The Lost Boys, email truthinmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Next week, Martin McDonagh reunites Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson for The Banshees of Inisherin. Park Chan-wook makes the decision to leave. And on Film Club, one more Park Chan-wook with the audacious tale of revenge, Old Boy. Thanks very much for tuning in. And if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif, and my guests this week were David Jenkins and Josh Slater-Williams. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Sankus.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.